Alliteration.
Yeah, alliteration.
Alliteration.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, take two.
How do I remember that?
So, yeah. Welcome to...
Stop giggling, Steve.
Welcome to bold, beautiful... What bees would you ascribe to Brixton, Rohit? Rohiti as well. If we had to do like a series of adjectives... What would be your Brixton? Brixton the...
Babylicious.
yeah. Meg says babylicious, so I'm going with that. Uh-huh. I'd say brave. Because a lot of people go to Croydon from here. So you've got to be brave about that. You know. I think I'll go with brave.
Brixton the brave.
Brixton the brave, yeah.
Okay.
Bring it on, Brixton.
Yeah. Well, as you can hear, I'm here this evening with my friend Rohit Telwar, who has been promising to do a Read Me Something You Love for how long?
A couple of months.
Yeah, quite a while.
Let's not get into how many.
Yeah. And finally, I've managed, he slotted me into his very, very busy whirlwind of social life and schedule. And
it's just a way to get rid of your text messages about, I had to do it, Steve. You made me do it. Good going.
Yeah. But I've really come out trumps this evening because I've got food and entertainment and now literary nourishment. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. But I know about the food, but what about the entertainment?
Entertainment is all the stuff in the kitchen, and get out of the kitchen, and I can't have you in my kitchen, and stop taking photographs of me. And
listeners, if you're ever inviting Steve to do a Read Me Something You Love, and if you're feeding him, do not let him enter your kitchen, because
right.
he takes pictures.
I'm making one of those. You know those like those recipe
Why would you,
things
no.
where you have like a step-by-step method and I have to photograph every part of the recipe as you make it?
Right. No, Steve, I think cooking is something it's such an intimate affair. You don't intrude like that.
Right.
You don't get into someone's kitchen and start taking pictures. That's rude, Steve.
Okay. Sorry.
Or should I say, that's rude, Stephen.
I feel sufficiently told off.
Good.
But may I say that I have experienced this evening, before we've even begun with the literary nourishment, probably one of the finest dulls. I mean, you laid on a whole smorgasbord of amazingness, but in that, one of the finest dulls I've ever tasted. And Rohit and I are possibly going to give a recipe for Mama Talwa's dull if you stay with us. If you don't stay with us, well, we'll probably give it to you anyway. So, Rohit, you've chosen... for those people who don't know Rohit, I said to him, how shall I introduce you? He said... What did you say?
See what you come up with. So this is your chance. Let's see what you come up with, Steve.
So I'm going to say something now. I'm going to introduce him, and he's going to disagree with this. He's going to say, no, I'm not actually this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Plus, you're really close to where I am, so, you know.
I would call you a sort of either marketing guru or marketing wunderkind. That's how I would... Advertising wunderkind. Advertising marketing, next Charles Saatchi wunderkind.
Okay. See, now that you've said I'm going to disagree with you, I'm going to have to not disagree with you. But then I can't really agree with you either. So we'll just go with it.
Would you be happy with that?
Yeah, I'm really happy with that.
Yeah.
Let's hope that
marketing
happens.
Guru.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like the sound. I don't like the sound of Charles Saatchi, but let's stick to the guru bit.
Morris Saatchi.
Morris Saatchi, yes, better. I mean, I think
He's got better glasses, Morris, hasn't he?
Yes, and I think he was a better advertising guy. But
because both. I mean, if you haven't seen a picture of Rohit, both him and I have got very, very good taste in glasses.
Yes, we do, sir.
Yeah.
Although I'm still trying to find the ones you wear, because, something like that.
Cutler and Gross.
Yeah, because, for the past 3 years, well, not three, let's say 13, I've been meaning to find something that Woody Allen wears.
Yeah, because we've actually just been looking at Rohit's Woody Allen book collection, and your glasses are definitely more Woody Allen than my glasses.
That's true. I think mine are probably more spherical than his. It probably needs
they're
work.
More sort
I still
of
haven't.
60s, 70s.
I've been looking, man. I still haven't found them.
Bananas, Woody Allen. Yeah,
I still haven't found them. Yes, yes.
Whereas mine are more, you know, that 4 or 5 years when he was sort of doing Bergman-esque films that neither of us have probably seen. Well, you've probably seen them.
Oh, I've seen all of them.
Yeah,
I've seen all of them.
Even the boring ones.
I've seen.
There were no boring ones.
What are you saying? No, there were no boring ones. Were
tearing your hair out ones? No.
Which ones? Which ones?
All the.
Are you sure you're still talking about Woody Allen?
You're not Bergman.
I don't.
I don't even know the names.
I don't.
September,
believe,
October. They've got names of months.
I don't believe you're still talking about Woody Allen. I think we should
serious black and white films. No.
Yeah, they were all lovely. How could you not have enjoyed them?
Okay. All right. So you have chosen to read a poem.
Yes, I have. I could have
very bold choice.
Is it? No, I
brave choice.
It was brave choice. Yeah, Brixton. No, see, when you live in Brixton, you've got to be brave. So yeah. This is an effort to establish that I'm a brave boy living in Brixton. See another alliteration there.
Yeah, yeah.
I decided to read this poem called "The Day the Sorcerers Came." Of course, I could have read anything Manuel Gaiman. Some of my most favorite stories, novels, graphic novels have been written by Neil Gaiman.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, shall we have it?
Sure.
And then we can talk a little bit more about it.
Done. The Day the Sorcerers Came by Neil Gaiman. That day, the sorcerers landed. Hundreds of them, golden, silent, coming down from the sky like great snowflakes. And the people of Earth stood and stared as they descended, waiting, dry-mouthed, to find what waited inside for us. And none of us knowing if we would be here tomorrow. But you didn't notice it, because... That day, the day the sorcerers came, by some coincidence, was the day when the graves gave up their dead, and the zombies pushed up through soft earth or erupted, shambling and dull-eyed, unstoppable, came towards us, the living, and we screamed and ran. But you did not notice this, because... On the Sorcerer Day, which was the zombie day, it was Ragnarok also, and the television screens showed us a ship built of dead men's nails, a serpent, a wolf, all bigger than the mind could hold, and the cameraman could not get far away. And then the gods came out. But you did not see them coming, because... On the saucer zombie battling gods day, the floodgates broke. And each of us was engulfed by genies and sprites, offering us wishes and wonders and eternities, and charm and cleverness and true brave hearts and pots of gold, while giants fifo-fummed across the land and killer bees... But you had no idea of any of this, because... That day, the Sorcerer Day, the Zombie Day, the Ragnarok and Fairies Day, the day the great winds came, and snows and the cities turned to crystal, the day all plants died, plastics dissolved, the day the computers turned, the screens telling us we would obey, the day angels, drunk and muddled, stumbled from the bars, and all the bells of London were sounded, the day animals spoke to us in Nacerin, the Yeti Day, the fluttering capes and arrival of the Time Machine Day. You didn't notice any of this, because you were sitting in your room, not doing anything, not even reading, not really, just looking at your telephone, wondering if I was going to call.
Thank you. That was a really, really great reading.
Thank you.
The day the sorcerers came. Is this a day that you yourself have ever imagined? I mean, the day of the aliens finally get to planet Earth.
Yes, it was. I think I believe all of us have lived through similar days.
Like I was saying... Through some days, as in seeing...
the way I see this poem is that... like I was telling you, the first time I read this, I couldn't care about anything. Uh-huh. Not even zombies, not aliens. Nothing. Because I was waiting for something to come about. Mm. And that's why it just sort of made me smile. But it sort of communicates the desperation, the weight, the anxiety. Or the fact that we should probably pay more attention to things around us,
mm-hmm.
even when we're doing other things.
Mm.
The things that probably seem more important to us at that moment. But something far more consequential, something far more interesting and fun is happening elsewhere. But we're not noticing it. There's a lot of that that I think of when I read this poem. Mm.
What do you it ends, okay, so for you obviously a lot of the meaning is in that ending. Not doing anything, not even reading, not really, just looking at your telephone, wondering if I was going to call. What do you think? Is this a man or a woman for you who's sitting with the telephone?
For me, I sort of pictured myself waiting for the phone to ring.
So it's a man.
Yeah. Hence, it's a man. Yeah. And the call sort of became an idea of things that I was waiting. And the funny thing is that the first time I read this poem, I was actually waiting for a phone call.
Oh, you were actually the character.
I was. The interesting thing is that the first time I was after my first degree, I had made job applications and I was hoping to get this one job. The gentleman had told me that he'll call me that day to tell me whether I had the job or not. I mean, I had the job, but it needed to be officially offered to me. I had been waiting all day and I was just restless and I needed to know whether it was happening or not. And
so like this character, completely focused on
the phone call
and the world could have been falling apart.
Anything could have happened. I mean, anything. Mm. I mean, the biggest tennis championship could have. I probably wasn't going to follow any updates because I was so focused on that phone call. I needed to know if I got the job.
Sure.
And it was all about that phone call, the desperation, the wait. And I just sort of, to keep myself occupied, I needed to do something.
This was almost like this poem was...
was written for me, really.
Had been sort of from the pen of Neil Gaiman to you
that day.
When you needed it.
Yeah. That's the reason it sort of made me smile so much that day. And ever so often, every time one of those, that situation comes about every once in a while. Mm. And when it does, I find myself going back to this sort of chuckling away, thinking, oh my God, I see how he's captured this emotion so well.
And do you think that helps to give you a sense of perspective when you are in that kind of automatic pilot, completely sort of self-focused, self-absorbed state? Does that help to give you some perspective? Do you sort of then, when you think of the poem, then think, hang on, I'm back in that self-absorbed state and I'm not really following what's going on around
exactly,
me.
Exactly, exactly. Just to sort of pay attention to things that don't seem so important right now, but probably are.
Mm.
And of course, they'd be far more interesting if zombies were coming up or computers were to turn our way and tell us that we would obey. But nonetheless, other important things are happening, and that, you're right, it kind of reminds me of, I probably shouldn't be so sort of self-absorbed and lost.
Uh-huh.
And
yet, in a way, which is perhaps what makes it so such a universal thing and something we all identify with, we all are this, whether we're waiting for a phone call or not, we all are kind of this character, aren't we? We're all so kind of absorbed in our own lives
exactly.
and our own
yeah.
issues that we don't really notice these often quite cataclysmic things happening
yes,
around
I,
us.
Yes, I agree with you, yeah. which is
historically, politically.
That's true, and I think it's only a man like Neil Gaiman who can just who can say something like that so beautifully, so simply. Mm. It's just so simply told. He puts all these ideas in your head, describes that there's so many extremes of things that that could be so wonderful or consequential, could be dreadful, could be amazing.
He doesn't do it in a... This could come across as a fairly moralistic poem, couldn't it? It's like, you know, these things were happening and you weren't paying attention. But he doesn't do that. He's got this lightness of touch. I mean, all
exactly.
the stuff about
yeah.
the where's that? I love that line with the fee-fo-fummed.
Oh, yeah, charmed.
Yeah,
the genies and sprites offering us wishes and wonders and eternities and charm and cleverness and true brave hearts and pots of gold, while giants fee-fo-fummed across the land and killer bees. But you had no idea of this because you were just waiting in your room looking at the damn telephone. It's just, I think he's captured it so simply.
I mean, what I find curious about that ending, that very, very important ending, is how he addresses it to the you. So it's, you didn't notice any of this because you were waiting for me to call. Which seems kind of curious. Any other writer would have written it, I did not notice any of this because I was waiting for you to call. And I'm just wondering, why do you think he addressed it to the you, and what happens when you say you were waiting for me to call rather than I was waiting for you to call?
I'm not sure. I think it's probably because he probably just wants to tell this, communicate this to you, that get over this idea that it's going to happen, this hope that I'm going to call, maybe.
Okay.
Or whatever you're waiting for is going to happen if you're just going to, you know, look at it and not do anything else. It's not going to happen like that. I don't know. Maybe it's just that. But
almost like words of caution, like, don't wait for me to call because I've
no
intention of calling.
Yeah,
and you're just wasting your life away
waiting for my call.
Waiting for
just
my call.
If I want to call, I'll call.
Right.
You know, you can't wait there and make me call you.
Because that does give us a slightly almost cruel twist.
It is very dark. It's funny for me to call.
And I'm not calling you because I'm writing this poem.
Because I'm writing this poem and I'm not going to. And yeah.
Yeah.
It's very it's like you said, it's cruel, but it's also very dark in a way, you know, you picture this guy this is how I see it. Just sort of sitting on his couch next to his telephone. Probably the lights are off in his room. Just sort of waiting.
Obsessing
over this telephone. And it's not ringing. And he picks it up and checks and everything's fine and nothing. And then he keeps it back because he says, oh my God, what if I missed the phone call when I took the receiver? So it's just that desperation and I think that's the image that I really enjoy because it's such a funny, but such a, it's something that most people can identify with. I mean, I can. If not in a dark room waiting by the telephone, I probably will have been in similar situations where I have waited for things to work for me because I'm selfish and I want that to happen for me. But something just comes and reminds me, oh, just because I'm obsessing over this is not going to happen. So I may have to step out of this state and do something about this.
What's ironic is that most of our discussion so far has been about the last five self-absorbed, self-obsessed lines.
Yeah.
And we've completely ignored the 95%, the majority of the poem, which is also what, of course, this person who is waiting for the phone call is doing.
He's not, well, is he redoing it? I think everything else is just, he's ignoring.
You didn't notice all of this
stuff. You didn't notice all of this. But there's no way for you to find out if all of that is happening because you're so absorbed. So he could make up anything and present to you, you're going to buy it.
Is there anything of worth saying, though? Because we're not going to do that, are we? We're not going to completely ignore 95% of the poem. We're more savvy than that.
We are.
And we're less self-absorbed than that.
We are.
What's going on for you in the 95% of the poem that happens before these last five words?
I think now that I know what happens, it's different. But when the first time I read it, I was just really amused, and I was just enjoying the ideas, the visuals that Neil Gaiman was throwing in my head.
Mm.
It flows so well. He takes me through a million things, and he makes me smile. He makes me sort of cringe at the thought of something that could be scary. Mm. He gets you excited about the possibility of zombies and computers turning. Those are my two favorite things in the poem, because I can just totally, if they were to happen, they would be spectacular. That day, the day the sorcerers came, by some coincidence, was the day when the graves gave up their dead, and the zombies pushed up through soft earth or erupted, shambling and dull-eyed, unstoppable, came towards us, the living, and we screamed and ran. But you did not notice this, because that day, the saucer day, the zombie day, the Ragnarok and fairies day, the day the great winds came and snows and the cities turned to crystal, the day all plants died, plastics dissolved, the day the computers turned, the screens telling us we would obey, the day angels, drunk and muddled, stumbled from the bars and all the bells of London were sounded, the day animals spoke to us in Acerin, the Yeti day, the fluttering capes and arrival of the time machine day. You didn't notice any of this, because you were sitting in your room, not doing anything, not even reading, not really. Just looking at your telephone, wondering if I was going to call.
So your two favorite and favorite fearful things are, one, the zombies, and the computers.
Computers turning and telling us that they would that we would obey, because as I see it, of course, it's different. As I see it, machines, if they start controlling us, it will be kind of tragic. And things will be out of control, and that he sort of touches upon that, but then he
because of course
on,
we're not controlled in any way by machines at the moment.
None
you
at
go
all.
On the tube,
of course,
and people
not.
Are sort of completely hooked into
and
their phones. We're not anyway
constantly
controlled.
Obsessing.
No.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, you know, he does. I mean, there is some truth there.
I find it interesting that for you those are the two really scary things, because for me, the scariest thing, which and clearly those are scarier things for Gaiman, because he puts them later on in the poem, doesn't he? You know, you were not noticing, and then this thing happened.
Yeah.
But for me, the scariest thing is actually the first thing. The sorcerers landing, hundreds of them, golden, silent, coming down from the sky like great snowflakes. And the people of the earth stood and stared as they descended, waiting dry-mouthed to find what waited inside for us. I really like the way he uses that.
Mm.
We're waiting to find out, you know, what's
in store for
what's,
us.
What's waiting for us.
Yeah.
For me, that's where the real chill is. And that's because I think perhaps I've often thought about what is it going to be like.
After that, he says, and none of us knowing if we would be here tomorrow. So you're right that, yes, it is scary.
Isn't that scarier? I'm positing. Then your stove switching off in the middle
not
of
the stove,
cooking,
perhaps, yeah,
or
not
your
my
MacBook,
MacBook yes, my
kind
MacBook
of saying to you, sorry, I'm, you know, taking a holiday now.
No, I don't know.
Isn't that scarier?
I just think it's more immediate.
Hundreds of them, golden, silent, coming down from the sky.
No, I think that's just what I looked at is probably just more immediate than the possibility of people landing, appearing out of a saucer. And
oh, so you don't think that there's likely?
No, it's likely, but I just probably don't think of it every day. It's probably just something that doesn't scare me every day.
So it's just me then?
Well, maybe. No, I'm sure you have company. I just think it'll be hard for you to find them.
Uh-huh. And what is it about the zombies that particularly frightens you? Because for me, you see, the zombies, it's almost cartoon-like.
It is.
Not as scary as those snowflakes.
Not scary.
Coming down.
I think, no, zombies probably aren't scary to me. Zombies are just an unpleasant memory from my childhood.
Ah.
I grew up really scared of zombies and all things zombie-like.
And what is scary about them?
Just the whole idea. Just really, the image in my head is just so bizarre.
Yeah.
And it really creeps me out.
Here they're described as pushing up through soft earth or erupting, shambling and dull-eyed, unstoppable. So it's the return of the dead, isn't it?
It is. And the way I see them and the way he's described them, you cannot tell what they're about to do, and they're approaching you, and they're unstoppable, and there's something so... You feel so helpless about it, and what you see is just so dreadful and ugly and threatening that you don't... I mean, and that's the image I've always... I think as a... I must have seen some stupid horror movie, and I still don't see them. I'm a wuss like that. And that's the image that I go back to every time someone mentions zombies. I mean, now I'm over it, thankfully. But yes, in a setup like this, it does make me... It brings that visual back. And that just, it leaves me uncomfortable.
I wonder,
not scary, but it's just uncomfortable.
I wonder if perhaps also this has a certain resonance for you, because growing up in India, I imagine you would have seen more dead bodies than I would come across
as a
child.
Can I quote you on that, Steve? Just is that, because I'd love to. decade from now.
I'm thinking funeral pyres and those sorts of things, which of course we're not subjected to in any way. Whereas I'd imagine...
No, I death for me personally has always, and like you said, yes, while growing up, there were a lot of dead people, trust me. And then it was always an understanding that, well, this is over. This is, the person's gone. This is the end of that chapter. Think about it, smile about it, cry for a bit, whatever, get over it, move on. It's
move
over.
Move on until the zombies start pushing out of your imagination.
Yeah, I just never thought of that. But I think some if I have lost any dear people, if they were to turn up suddenly, I don't think I'd be scared. I'd probably be happy.
Mm. Unless they were pushing up through soft earth or erupting, shambling, and dull-eyed.
Exactly. Until that happens, I'd be quite glad.
Yeah.
I mean, if my grandfather, if I'm allowed to say it, just suddenly turns up, that would be amazing, because I loved him so much and he loved me. So the thing is that if they were to come back in the state I knew them in,
yes,
in the loving grandfatherly state, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
But if the other thing were to happen, I don't even want to picture it, because there's just too many wonderful, good memories while growing up of that man that I don't want to change.
Sure.
Right? So it's probably the idea that something's over, and I probably have been programmed in a manner that it's over and it's gone. Don't, you know, it's over for a reason, and... So for good, it's not going to come back. Mm. But if it does...
I mean, fear is a very personal thing, isn't it? Because zombies don't bother me, and I don't think have ever bothered me. But as I say,
aliens
something
did.
About these aliens coming out of the silence, that golden, the silence of them coming down from the sky like great snowflakes. There's something about that that I find beautiful and ominous... At the same time,
it is. But I think it's more beautiful and more sort of full of opportunities, full of ideas for me, because I think that's where imagination really kicks in, because you can picture a different life on a different planet if they were to take you with them, or if they were to change this planet into something else. That would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
But we don't know, do we?
But we don't know.
As it says in the poem, we are waiting dry mouthed to find what waited inside for us. We're waiting, they're possibly waiting dry mouthed as well.
Yeah, and none of us knowing if we would be here tomorrow. Exactly, but I don't know whether they are scared or if we are scared, but the possibility
we're
of discovering...
We're both scared, possibly.
Yeah, but then the possibility... Well, I'm guessing they're probably more powerful. If they're not, then we'll just see how it goes. That's where the imagination comes in, because then there's this possibility of a different world, of something that doesn't exist, but we could build to accommodate them or to change their plans, perhaps. And that's what I enjoy about the aliens bit, because I actually that actually makes me smile, because I think of things that are probably not that don't exist right now. But if we were to go to other planets, I'd probably see different things, and that gets me excited.
So, and that's, I think, also what he's also presenting as the bounty of literature, because that sense of imagination presenting you new worlds which you you would never have thought of. And even if you have thought of zombies, you haven't thought of sorcerer zombie battling gods.
Yes.
I mean, he strings them all together. He kind of builds it up and up and up and kind of creates all these sort of permutations, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, that's what I really enjoyed about this poem, because it's just full of ideas that... And then he takes you along on this wonderful, extravagant journey full of ideas. This constantly kind of encourages you in a way to sort of be more imaginative about things.
There will be, Rohit, there will be a few people listening to this podcast who probably one in a million, clearly.
Yeah.
Particularly, I need to say this just in case Neil Gaiman is listening. One in a million who have got no interest in Neil Gaiman, who possibly even find him and his work odious, but have been listening all this time because they have been waiting for Mama Talwa's dal recipe. And now we are going to reward those people. Sorry, you are going to reward those people by telling them how to make Mama Talwa's secret dal recipe.
Please.
You are going to, yeah? Please.
Should I? Do you think my mom's going to be okay with it? Well, it's a very simple chana dal recipe. Once you get the split beans, aka chana dal, ready, which is to say you boil it with turmeric powder. The yellow split peas. Yes.
Yeah. Boil with turmeric powder.
Boil with turmeric powder and salt.
Boil what consistency?
Just boil it once.
Yeah, boil it. Okay. So get it up
just
to a boiling
get
point.
Get it up. Just sort of prepare the split beans to be cooked, in the sense that because they, you can eat them otherwise, right? But to make dal out of it, you have to.
Oh, okay. So actually, boil them until they are of a
consistency.
Until they soften up.
Yeah,
okay.
They soften up.
But
a
not
bit.
Mushy.
No. They okay. soften up a bit. They will be a little mushy later. So let them cook then on while you're doing this, just make tadka in another pan. Just
and the tadka recipe is?
Tadka recipe is very simple. It's heat oil in another pan, put cumin seeds, some garlic, chop it finely so it won't sort of come and kick you when you eat it. Put them in the pan. When the cumin seeds start popping up, just put in just a hint of chili powder and some garam masala. And by this time, the chana dal is thicker because it's been cooking on a low beam. Put some tomatoes and onion in the...
This is fresh tomatoes.
Fresh tomatoes and fresh onion in the dal. And throw the tadka on top and let it cook for about half an hour. Stir it once in a while, just perhaps once in 10-15 minutes.
Seasoning, I mean, in terms of salt, a bit of...
Yeah, so tonight I've learned, and everyone should know this, so from now on, if anyone invites Steve for dinner, like I did, please keep extremely... high amount of salt ready.
Good salt.
Yeah, which is
I mean,
to say,
you had salt. You had loads of salt.
I had
just
salt, but
my
it was
nose up.
What was
my
it?
Salt.
What was it? 6%, and you had
it was the low
there.
Sodium.
It was
salt.
A low was, sodium
yeah,
salt.
Yeah.
So you know, this man has major blood pressure concerns. So just keep salt handy, because he's going to put salt of everything,
and ketchup.
Yeah,
as well,
and
probably,
oh my
yeah.
God, I'm glad I didn't have
yeah,
ketchup.
I know. I would have.
I'm glad I didn't ask for ketchup because
no,
you know
it was.
With what I made, the ketchup would have ruined everything. You know, ketchup reminds me of like horrible things from my childhood. Actually, just you know, just how you put ketchup on everything, and your parents just tell you not to because things are not meant to be consumed like that.
I haven't
outgrown
that.
But you're a child, and you want to ruin everything.
Absolutely,
you know, essentially, you just want to make everything to look red and ugly and taste like.
Ketchup. Yeah, yeah.
And, and yeah, so I'm glad you didn't ask for ketchup.
Well, thank you for sharing with us tonight, Gaiman.
I hope you have more Gaiman fans.
Are they going to flock to this to this podcast, I think, as soon as any gaming hits the web.
I still, you know, I'm yet to meet that man, but when I do, I'll tell him about our podcast. That'll be great.
Thank you, Rohit.
My pleasure. Thank you.